Hi, my name is Jamie Ridgway, the head coach and owner of the Renaissance Academy of Martial Arts. And today I want to tell you about some of the programs that we offer at the Academy. So in our Little Dragons programs, our 4 to 6 year old class, that class is designed for, you know, teach kids focus. You know, at that age, it's very difficult for them to focus. So we want to teach them focus. We want to teach them basic tumbling, basic martial arts skills. At the same time, you know, stranger danger, what to do if there's somebody that comes along they don't know and how to act. So we go over all those things, kind of a prep program for kids. We teach a lot of jiu-jitsu in there too. The 7 to 12 year old kids, now they're a little more mature and they're ready to start taking a big piece of the information as far as like martial arts classes. So in that class, we teach them Taekwondo blended with Muay Thai kickboxing, blended with Gracie jiu-jitsu, so that they are well-rounded. They can kick, punch, clinch, and grapple. And that's where, you know, in today's world, we see a lot of self-defense situations end up, is on the ground. So they need to know that too. So when they come out with a junior black belt, not only are they focused, but they're also well-rounded as a martial artist. And you're gonna see things like respect and self-discipline at home through the program, because that's the most important thing that we're teaching the kids. And that is, hey, we don't want them to learn all these skills and not showing respect and saying yes ma'am and no ma'am and doing their chores at home. That's really what it's all about.
Sojourners, my name is Obey, your host. Welcome to the Podyssey. My guest today is Dr. Andrew Anderson. Dr. Andrew Anderson is a family medicine doctor in Lynchburg, Virginia. He received his medical degree from A.T. Still University School of Osteopathic Medicine. He's also an adjunct professor at Liberty University's School of Osteopathic Medicine, and he's also my primary care physician. Please welcome to the Podyssey, Dr. Andrew Anderson. How are you doing?
Thanks. This is exciting.
This is a lot. I'm really pumped. So I wanted to invite you on, you know, this podcast to kind of just talk through some things that I thought would be really interesting. Like one of them being, of course, healthcare. Yeah. And then two being something that you had started called direct primary care. But before we even get into any of that, I kind of want to get to know you. Like, I know you as my primary care physician, but I want to know a little bit about your story. So like, where are you from? Okay. How'd you meet your wife?
All right.
When did you know you wanted to be a doctor? Was it like someone skidded their knee and you didn't pass out like me at the blood?
So let's see. When I was a kid, I told my mom I wanted to be a garbage man. And I think she lost all hope at that point. And things fast forwarded a little bit, and I ended up serving a 2-year mission for church out in the Philippines.
Nice.
And things changed a little bit then. But before that, when I was in college freshman year, I finally declared my major as an art history major. I was really proud of myself. And then I came home and I was at my best friend's house, and his dad was like, "Oh, I heard you're an art history major." And I was really proud, and I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "I heard a funny joke. What's the difference between an art history major and a large pizza? Large pizza can feed a family of 5. Thanks. I started thinking, what does he actually mean by that? I mean, I get the joke, but oh man. And so I was on my mission. I was there for 2 years.
Then
there was this big car accident, and I got to use my Boy Scout first aid.
You were Boy Scout?
Lady. I was, yeah.
Wow.
And helped this lady out, saved her leg. She had a big bleed in an artery in her leg.
Wait. How old are you at this time?
I was 19.
You were 19?
Yeah.
A lady's bleeding out.
Yeah, she was becoming delirious and stuff, and it was crazy.
And you were just calmly, like...
I could say I was calm now, but I don't think I was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, I would have probably been next to her hyperventilating, so you'd be like, I got one hyperventilating, one bleeding out, I need help.
Yeah, so I ended up, I didn't know much. All I knew was first aid from Boy Scouts, and so I put a tourniquet on her after I couldn't get the bleeding to stop any other way, she lived, and things were cool, and it was just neat. And so, for me, it gave me a point to recognize, you know, I did a lot of work to know this much. Like, I could speak the language. It was a unwritten language in a little tiny island in the Philippines. And then I knew the Boy Scout first aid stuff. And that all combined allowed me to help this lady. And I was like, you know, a little preparation can go a long way. So I wanted to do more preparation to go even further to help people. So that's kind of what sparked things.
Wow.
And came home and decided to ditch the art history thing. And
you wanted to feed more than a family. I got
yeah,
you. I got you.
Yeah, we now have a family of six. As
look
of
at you.
3 weeks ago.
You proved him wrong.
Yeah.
But do you still like, are you still into art at all? Or do you still use that side of
not
yourself?
As much. No, okay. I don't. I mean, about as artsy as I get now is the stuff you see on my office walls.
Right, right.
That's about it.
Just a little woodworking?
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so where would you say, like, you met your wife, you know, that whole, and kind of like you grew into that in med school? Where did that happen?
Yeah, so I met her, ended up going, we met at a rodeo at BYU, and she ended up sitting next to me, and next thing you know, we were married about a year later.
Now, by rodeo, like you...
Like a out west rodeo.
Like Old Town Road. Yeah. I got the horses.
Not,
the
oh, gosh.
Like, I'm just making sure I clarify. Like
it was real Idaho
now,
rodeo.
Was that like a thing you did normally?
No, I didn't. I'm from out here. I'm from like a little redneck town about 30 miles outside of here. And I was like, a rodeo? This is great. And so I went, invited a bunch of people. She came with her best friend, sat next to me, and we got married 10 months later.
Get it, my man.
Went to med school, ended up going out to Missouri for med school.
Wow, nice.
Yeah. You were asking a little bit about MDs versus DOs before we got the show started.
Yeah.
This is a good segue into this because this is where it all started for me.
Okay.
When I was applying to schools here in Virginia, I applied to MD schools because that's what I knew. Medical doctor,
of course.
You know, MD.
Right.
Do it. And so... I was working at an ER down in Richmond, Virginia, and I was shadowing an MD, and there was a construction worker, about 40, came in with some kind of sciatica type thing.
Mm.
And I remember he doped him up with medication. He had to have somebody come give him a ride home, and he was out of work for like 5 days.
Wow.
The next day, and that was with an MD that I was shadowing. I was in college at the time. And the next day I was with the DO, and we almost had like an identical patient come in. 40-year-old construction worker with a like sciatica kind of issue going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember this DO like setting him down, giving him a little bit of medicine, and like twisting him around, and I didn't know what he was doing, and like his legs, and trying to get the muscles to relax and whatever, and he's describing it to him, and I didn't really know what was going on. And then the patient walked out. On his own, didn't have to call a buddy to come pick him up, didn't
come
have to
on.
Get wheelchaired out.
Yeah.
And the guy showed up at the ER the next day. And the doc that I was with, Dr. Clark, said, Andrew, you need to go see what's going on because why is he back at the ER? And he came to say thank you. And that was the only time I've worked in the ER since then, I mean, for years now.
Yeah, yeah.
That anybody's ever come back to say thank you. And he said, I work construction, we live paycheck to paycheck, and that buddy that came yesterday was a buddy of mine, and we have stuff like this happen all the time because we do hard labor.
Come on.
And he was out for 5 days, and he couldn't do anything, and I got a little doggy bag of medicine just in case.
Right.
And I'm back at work, and I'm paying my bills, and thank you. And that was it. And so I was like, what is different? So I asked Dr. Clark, I was like, does everybody do that? Because the guy yesterday didn't do that. And he said, no, I'm a DO. And I was like, tell me more. And so he did. And I ended up applying to the DO schools in the country. And
come on.
Got accepted to the one in Missouri, which was the original. And it was the number one ranked at the time. And I wanted like the true DO experience. And so that's where I went. And that's why I went.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. So... one of the things I always hear when people, like, I try to explain to them, like, yeah, my doctor's a DO,
yeah.
is that they think that it's, like, below an MD. So could you dispel that? Because I feel like people don't understand, like, you are not going to a lesser medical school if your doctor's a DO. Or, you know, an MD does not mean that you have this finer knowledge. Like, you are both medically trained. You can go into, I believe, all forms of medicine,
yeah.
and you can become a surgeon, neurosurgeon, anything.
Yeah. And so, and the reason I went the DO route is because I could do more. I mean, I could do everything an MD does, but then just a little bit extra.
That's awesome.
And the other thing that I liked about Dr. Clark was that he taught me about the approach that DOs take, something that they try to instill in their students, is to treat the patient as a whole patient and not just the illness at the moment. And you and I have had conversations like that where we kind of talked about everything, ranging from meat to not losing weight to all kinds of stuff. And and that rung true to me, and that was important. And so that's why I pursued that, because not only do you have a few extra things to do clinically, but they also try to teach you to approach the patient as a whole person and not just an illness.
And I've definitely felt that. I think that's what, when I met you, I really was like happy that I remembered to go that route. And honestly, it was because of, you know, with Liberty University starting the DO school, and I was looking for a new primary care doctor. I just got tired. Like, the doctor I had before you, no offense to that person, but it was just, I did not like the in and out and the heavy prescription-based, you know, form of medicine. I just felt there had to have been another way. And what was cool was, like, when you meet DOs, people that have been trained like this, I believe this is how medicine should be. Like, you are trying to get to know someone as the whole person. So their emotional health, their mental health, their physical health. And so you're trying to talk to them and actually treat them as a whole person rather than just, like, an ailment that needs to be attacked and then send them out as if, like, the medicine they're taking does not affect. I think that's a larger issue with our healthcare industry. It just seems like we have forgotten the heart behind healthcare. To be is really focusing on the patient and really trying to build that patient and doctor relationship so that you can better serve your patients.
Yeah. You know? And I just feel like if there was more to know, then I might as well know it.
Yeah.
So I went that route. And I mean, I got accepted to all the MD schools that I applied to as well. So.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, you're brilliant. Yeah, the people know that the sojourners that are listening to this podcast right now are like, this guy is good. Like, come on now. Like, I mean, they you don't have to even say that. Come on. I mean, if I think back to when I was in high school and like thinking back to like college and all and just growing up, like doctors, like you, I never knew that doctors could be funny and just personable. It just seemed like they would be like that, this certain type of guy. I think you also do break that persona too as well. Like, a doctor could be someone who's personable, funny, get to know you, laugh.
And have a crappy car.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. Now, see, that's surprising. Like, people think that doctors are like all rich. They all drive, you know, BMWs. And I remember when I started going to Boonesboro DPC, which you own, that when you drove in that Jeep, like an old Jeep from like 10 years, I was like...
21 years.
Oh, I apologize.
It's old.
So you just like are a normal, humble guy. Like this is a passion for you. You can make money, but it's not like your goal. Your goal is the patient, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and if you talk to a lot of docs, they'll say the same thing. I had a different approach. I mean... getting into some of the other subjects that we talked about, but just how healthcare has now changed and makes docs see people so fast, I just had to put the brakes on a little bit.
Yeah, so, let's talk about that, because when I came to, you know, get to know you and, you know, the whole healthcare industry.
Yeah,
let's start from the basic, like. What is health, like, for people that don't understand? Like, let's go into the basics. Like, what is healthcare? What is health, like, insurance?
Oh yeah.
And then what is, like, what are you getting when you go, like, for example, like a DPC route? So let's break down the three out, like, just these three options. I think people need to understand, like, when they're thinking,
this is good.
Yeah, when they're thinking about, you know, politically or anything. Like, first off, let's just start off. What is healthcare?
So. Healthcare is taking care of people, period.
Period.
You know, that's it. It's easy. Healthcare, what it has become, is super complicated.
Okay.
I mean, there have been 7, now 8 presidents trying to reform healthcare.
Right.
Nobody can, because it's incredibly complicated. Mm. It's interesting, but stupid complicated.
Right.
And so, because insurance has gotten involved, insurance started a jillion years ago, not that long ago, but when... people had, like, a village had a, you know, some barn or something, and it held all kinds of stuff, and everybody put a pot of money in, and they're like, yeah, if my house burns down or the barn that holds half of the stuff that we're selling burns down, then we can use that money to purchase a new one.
Gotcha.
And that's it. And so if your house started on fire, you cashed in the insurance.
Gotcha.
And then it is changed. And so that's what insurance still is for your house. That's what it is for your car. But health insurance has changed. Because there's been three major parties involved.
Okay.
So there's the patient.
Okay.
There's the doctor, and there's health insurance. The doctors, over and over and over the past several decades, have shown that they'll do whatever's altruistic, whatever's in the best interest of the patient. The patient as a whole doesn't really know what's going on.
Right.
And then you have the insurance company that capitalizes on both of those positions.
Okay.
And so they've changed things a little bit. And so before, when insurance was to protect against one event, it said, yes, we're charging for, yes, this one event, and we're going to keep this pot of money. But also, it's going to become like prepaid healthcare too. And so when your shutter falls off your house or you get a flat tire, you don't expect your insurance to pay for it, like car insurance or house insurance, but you do expect for your health insurance to pay for it. So it's become this like weird conglomeration of these two ideas, like, hey, we're protecting against an eventuality or a possibility. And then on the other side, we're looking, hey, we're prepaying for our healthcare. So we're covering colonoscopies. We're covering a certain amount as long as you pay the deductible. We're covering this and medication and all that. And so, and so all of a sudden it's become really expensive because you're prepaying for possibilities. And so you start prepaying for this guy's possible COPD because he's been smoking for the past 63 years.
Right.
And this person's type 2 diabetes. And here you are, you know, a healthy obe that doesn't have anything going on unless it's self-inflicted.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. I love that. That was good. That was good. And so people need to understand that when they're starting to really look at, like, if I want healthcare to get better, then you must understand that first basis of what is healthcare, what is health insurance, and how does that affect all parties involved?
So it involves parties insanely. Like, I could talk about this a lot.
No,
so,
please.
So there's two things that we can look at immediately. One that's really easy is how many people have gotten their fingers in the pie. One is PBMs, pharmacy benefit.
Pharmacy.
What's the M stand for? Managers, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
And so all they've done, have you read about this at all?
I have not. You know what? You catch me up.
So just the Reader's Digest version is it's this like middleman that's just kind of invented itself. And there's more to it than this. There's a lot more to it than this that is in between the drug companies and the insurance companies. And more or less, they make up these. It's kind of like Kohl's. Have you ever shopped at Kohl's?
Yeah.
And so they're like, hey, it's 30% off, but really they jack up the price and then they drop it 30%.
Right.
And so it's kind of the same thing. They get these like self-imposed kickbacks. They're like, oh, we're saving you a bunch of money if you do ABC and you prescribe these medications, but not these medications, and we're saving you money, but it's not. It's kickbacks at the end of the day. And so the price of medications has skyrocketed. I don't know the most recent number, but it's up a lot. And these medications are old. I mean, they're getting older. They're easier to manufacture. They've been around long enough. Patents are expiring. There's a whole discussion about that. But, and so that's just an example of how many fingers are in the pie. And there's a lot of middlemen coming up healthcare.
Yeah.
And it's just making things really complicated and really expensive. And so you have to play games. Like I had a patient, this is my old practice, and this happens with this type of medication all the time, diabetic medications and inhalers.
Okay.
So she was a Medicare patient, and she didn't even know she was a Medicare patient. And so I prescribe a medication for an inhaler that's like $380. And I was like, so we're not going to do that. We're going to prescribe the Walgreens version that's like $50.
Okay.
And she was like, okay, this is good. And she went there, and the pharmacist was like, well, your insurance doesn't cover the big medication. We could do something else that's super expensive, like $380 instead of the cheaper one. And so this lady was like, you know, what do I do? Well, I'll go for the one insurance pays, which was way more. So it's costing the system $380 versus one that is clinically like identical
for $50.
And then they tell her, plot twist, that, you're actually responsible for $189 of it. And she was like, okay, well, that doesn't make sense. And this lady, understandably, said, I'll go for the $50 one. Thanks, doc. And that's it. But the point is that the system has these weird back deal, like back alley deals that are going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's costing the system a ton. I mean, there's something that is clinically equivalent that's $50. And instead, because of this weird backroom stuff that's happening,
right,
it's costing the system 200-ish bucks in this case.
Right.
And then she's still responsible for about $200.
Right.
And so it's just weird. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but it's happening all the time.
Right.
I feel like a conspiracist right now. But
No.
But it's, I mean...
Right, you're speaking the truth. And I remember listening to a podcast with a researcher who was talking about... And I think people need to really research when they think about like drug prices, because I didn't know what went into all of it. And so he, on this podcast, was speaking on how... Just to create some of these drugs, you're talking about millions, hundreds of millions of dollars invested.
Yeah.
So a company will spend billions. One of these drugs may become Tylenol and then go to mass market and make you money. But if it doesn't,
yeah,
then you've lost hundreds of millions of dollars. So a lot of people don't realize like the whole industry, and then like there's all these back deals, there's middlemen. And so it's a lot more complicated, I think, when you start to really like do your research and really listen to people that have studied this. Because when you look at, for example, the podcast I was listening to was talking about cancer medication. And it's so because demand is demand, so you need that to live, it's going to become a certain price. But also to even get through the FDA and get everything approved is just so many loopholes. And I think a lot of people, they think when they see you, Dr. Anderson, it's like, well, why can't you do something for me? Or like some people think that the doctors – are charging too much. They don't, or this person's charging too. They don't know who to get upset at.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's tough for a lot of people.
And people do get upset at the doc, and that's, you know, because we're the front men in some of this.
Yeah.
And so that was the one side of why healthcare has become complicated, is because there's so many people in this puzzle that doesn't need to be a puzzle. And then the other side is just quality of care has changed. And I'll tell you a little bit about how insurance has changed that.
Okay.
So MIPS. Have you ever heard of MIPS?
I have not.
Okay, good. This is good. So let me make sure I get this right. It is Merit-Based Incentive Payment System. You got that?
Okay.
Merit-Based Incentive Payment System. And so what it is in a nutshell is they say, docs, you need to be providing not just care. Instead of you doing a service and us paying you for said service, we need to make sure that you're doing a quality service. And so we're going to throw quality into the metrics as to how much or little you get paid. And so what they did is they came up with this grading scale.
Okay.
And they said there's going to be these quality measures. That's what they call them. And that will determine how good of a doctor you are. And so they didn't tell the docs what they were, because the doctors, like everybody, would study to the test, you know?
Aha.
Just like...
Once you knew the cheat code, once you knew what they wanted, you just give them what they want.
Yeah, and so they said, you know, we're going to look at stuff. And so there's all these people and administrators and doctors and everybody in between saying, okay, this is probably what they're looking at. And so...
Right.
People's blood sugar who have diabetes, if it's under this level, what percentage of your patients have it controlled under said level? How many of your patients over 50 have colonoscopies and females' mammograms at a certain age, and yada, yada, yada. And it just goes on and on,
right,
from vaccines to preventative medicine to BMI to everything.
Right.
And so we don't know exactly what it is. And so all of a sudden, because there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. So the people that get... an A plus on this grading scale, they'll get more money. The people that get a D minus, they will lose money, and it'll go to the people that get an A plus. And the people that get a C, it'll go to the people that get B. And so that's what's happening. And the majority of the healthcare dollar goes to hospitals. So hospitals are really driving it. And hospitals have a ton of administrators that allow for all this mumbo jumbo to happen.
Okay.
Another stat. I'm full of stats. Since 1975 to 2010, the population has grown roughly 150%. Number of doctors has grown roughly 150%.
Okay.
The percentage growth of healthcare administrators has grown by 3,200%.
Oh my gosh.
And so whether or not they're needed, I don't know. I mean, I don't think they are.
Yeah.
Not to that degree, at least.
Of course.
But those are high salaried people that are doing all this bean counting and telling docs what needs to happen so that the hospital makes ends meet.
Exactly. Okay.
And so now you have these doctors and more likely these hospital systems, not the doctors, that are trying to cross their T's and dot their I's and try to get everything straight when in 2020, when the report card comes out,
yeah,
they're not going to be on the losing end of that report card. And so you have all these mandates that are put out by hospital systems and
right.
healthcare systems
right.
To try to do all that, check all the boxes that we don't know what they are or which ones actually matter and which ones don't. And so it is prompting a lot of burnout from physicians because we right. got into it for the first thing you mentioned, taking care of people.
Right.
And so health insurance came in and now it's impeding on our ability to take care of patients.
Come on.
And so the AMA, the American Medical Association, did a study out of, I think it was the University of Wisconsin. I think it was published about a year ago, maybe a little longer, to look at the average family doc, see what they're doing these days, because they're saying, I'm getting burned out with too much paperwork and too much clicking and check boxes.
Because how many patients does the average doctor have?
So that's a different topic, but between like 2,500 and 3,500.
Okay. That's a lot. That seems like a lot.
It's interesting. It is. And so, especially when there's more paperwork. And so they did a study and they said that the average family doc works 11.4 hours a day. And then they looked at how everything was broken up. So 49% of that time was entering data into a computer. The more telling statistic is 27% of that time is face-to-face with patients. That's it. 3.01 hours of the 11.4 hours that they're gone from their family is actually talking to patients.
Wow.
And so you look at the other time, I mean, where is that all going?
Yeah.
And you wonder, like, why we can't take care of people and why we are spending, what, $10,000 per person per year in healthcare costs. Like, that's how much the government is paying. And we're way down here on the level of healthcare that we provide. I mean, that's why, in a nutshell, there's a lot more to it because it is a complicated situation. But
right.
But that right there is really complicating things.
Yeah, man. Thank you for clarifying that. I know there are sojourners, fans of this podcast, who be listening to this and be like, this is what I wanted to hear. This is why I came here, because this is so important. So now you're starting to see with the grading scale, with the amount of patients, with the amount of hours you're working, and then also like the amount of time you actually are spending with patients, you're seeing the burnout. Like what you want to do is only 3 hours a day. Yeah. And the other 8 hours is spent doing things you don't want to do. And then you also have the complications of like drug pricing. You have the complications of just, you know, the long hours. I mean, 11.4 hours a day.
Yeah, that's on average. And so,
and how many days a week would that be?
Five.
Wow.
Yeah. And so you asked about, this is interesting too, the number of patients.
Yeah.
So back in the 90s, they did a study and they're like, okay, how many patients and do people have? And this is a roundabout way, I don't know how it all started, but they said, this is what a physician has to do
right.
throughout a day. And so to do that with 2,500 patients, which was what the estimate was.
Yeah.
That's what they did, and just, you know, polling everybody, how many patients do you have and you.
Yeah.
It came to about 2,500. And this is back in the 90s. It's worse now. And they did this study that said, yeah, they would require, I can't remember, it was over 21 hours per day to do what a physician needed to do to take care of 2,500 patients. And so they said, that can't be true because a doctor would need so much time to actually take care of that few patients.
Right.
I can guarantee that's how many patients, I mean, that doctors have. I mean, there's a lot of docs in here because we don't have family docs in the town just because nobody's moving to Central Virginia to be a doctor.
Come on.
For whatever reason.
You're right.
I mean, I'm from the area, so I came back to the area. It's great.
I love that.
But so there's just a lot of patients and not a lot of doctors.
Right.
And so 2,500, I think, for here is low. I think
that's
there's some
incredible.
With a lot more and plenty with double. Yeah.
And I think that's why you see, like, when I said, like, when I went to my primary care doctor before you, it was like a laptop and a girl like just like taking notes, and he's in there 10, 20 minutes. I mean, you wait an hour, hour and a half.
Yeah.
You take time out of work.
Yeah.
You're frustrated because of that. And in the weight room, you're like, what's taking so long? And you don't realize they're just trying to pump these out. Go, go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And like, try to get done in 20 minutes.
Yeah. My average lunchtime was between 8 and 17 minutes long. My longest lunchtime was 17 minutes. And so like, I mean, I wasn't like just hanging around. I mean, a lot of the time it would be like a sandwich on the way to the bathroom.
Come on.
And then go back to patients. And so, I mean, because you don't like to make anybody behind, and patients get upset. And
yeah.
You don't like to be behind because then
no, you're, I'm glad you're saying
slow
that.
Getting home.
Right. And, well, yeah. Because I think people need to understand that, like, for doctors, you are human beings. You have you came into this business, into this industry, wanting to help people. You love people, yeah. And if you people actually study the history of doctors, it was always about the patient. Y'all used to come to people's homes. Used to do births in people's homes. Like, and I think people still do that with a midwife. But it's incredible how people have forgotten that, like, a doctor, because now everyone ever sees is a dollar amount. They think, okay, he's making $250,000. What's he crying about? But they don't realize what's the quality of life for this person. So you're here, you know, in Central Virginia. You got, let's say, 3,500 patients. You're spending only 3 hours a day actually meeting those patients. And so I think it kind of leads you to try to figure out a way out, right? Which led you to think about what a DPC might be.
Yeah. Interesting statistic. Again, the suicide rate of, and this is a serious subject, but the suicide rate of physicians is now double what it is of active military. And so
I've never heard that.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And so, I mean, you have to ask why. I mean, the people that are taking care of other people, why can't they take care of themselves? There's a lot more to it than that,
of course.
That's
powerful.
And it's a serious subject. Yeah. But you have to ask, why is that number what it is? And so I was feeling that. I mean, as a doc, I was not happy. I was depressed. I had this moral injury. I mean, I went to school. I lived in a basement apartment in Philadelphia. I hauled my family across the country many times just to get a good education. And and then all of a sudden I'm asked and almost forced. I mean, the situation forces you to see a ton of people and take mediocre care of a whole lot of folks. And so I was just like, this is not what I signed up for. And
How long did you see that? Like when you were like, this is not what I like. Was it like immediate or was
it
over time?
No, it wasn't. Because like, in residency, I mean, they work you like a rented mule. I mean, I was working 110 hours.
And what is residency for those that don't know?
Okay, so
right,
you do 4 years of college, you go to med school for 4 years, and then you go to residency training for 3 to 7 years.
Man, this is a long journey.
After that, depending on what you go into. For a family doc, we do 3 years, and you work a lot. It's like boot camp for doctors. I mean, they have made it illegal to work super long shifts, but there's a lot of residency programs that at the time wrote and said, hey, we're still going to work them just as long because we can't produce quality doctors in a fraction of the time. You know, they can't stand up next to these other docs that worked so many hours and say, I worked a third of the hours that you did, but expect them to be the same quality. And so my residency was one of those. And so we worked a lot. I remember my first 30-hour shift, and I learned to sleep standing up. I would go into the bathroom, and I'd take all the stuff, like all the little books and pens and stuff out of my lab coat, and I'd lean up against the corner in the bathroom in the ICU, and I'd just like doze off, and then my hands would go limp when I finally dozed off, and everything would drop to the ground. It would wake me up. I'd pick them up and hit it again for another 5 or 6 hours.
Come on.
And so we work hard.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And so you do that in residency training, and then you come out and you are used to working really hard, and so you just keep on going until all of a sudden you realize like, hey, this is supposed to be like the glory time,
right,
when I'm finally doing what I've worked so hard to do, like 11 years of serious education and a lot of debt.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're not. And for me, it was about 2.5 years into it where it was just that carrot of life being set finally, where like I had a good schedule. I could see my kids again because I'd been working so long and I'd missed every holiday you can imagine and anniversaries and birthdays and all that stuff. And now I was supposed to be available for those things again. And I wasn't available for my patients too. So it was a double whammy for me. Wow. And I think for every doc. Yeah, I don't think I was unique in that.
I love that. That's powerful. That's powerful. So all that time builds up. You're now, you know, thousands of patients in. You're in Central Virginia. And then you make the weird decision to say, I'm bucking the system.
Yeah, and
I'm cutting out of the matrix. I'm doing something different.
And so it is a little nerve-wracking to challenge the status quo. And so I looked at kind of the top seven things that my patients complained about. Okay. And I was like, you know, like, if I can get out of that, then I can take care of them and I can be happy and they can be happy and they can be really healthy compared to the average patient. And I can take care of them. And so I found something called direct primary care. And the reason direct is in it is because it cuts out some of these middlemen that complicate things so much.
Okay.
And so namely insurance.
Okay.
And some of the governing and stupid stuff that they require me to do. So where before I was statistically doing 49% of my time entering crap into a computer and then only spending 3 of my 11.4 hours with patients, it's totally different now. I mean, I talk with patients. I have time to do stuff like this.
Right.
And, and I get to know my patients, and it makes a huge difference. It makes difference in them. I mean, because as a family doc, I don't specialize in a body part. Like, I'm not a cardiologist. I don't specialize in the heart or a nephrologist in the kidneys. I'm a family doc. I specialize in the patient. And so for me, it got to this, like, fever pitch where I think I was running an errand for my wife. I was at the store last year, and I meet a patient, and she's like, "Hey, Dr. Anderson." I'm like, "Hey there, partner," you know, and like, I didn't know her name, and I was really embarrassed, and I think I played it off better than that, but I was like, "Oh my gosh, you know, I don't know my specialty." And literally 2 minutes later, the same thing happened with a totally different patient at the same store.
Wow.
I'm like, "Hey there, buckaroo," you know, and I just didn't know, you know, I didn't know too much about him, and I was embarrassed, and I was like, and I was worried. I had this like eye-opening experience where I was like, oh my gosh, that is what I'm taking care of, and I'm not. I'm good at names. I'm one of the few guys that is good at names, and I can't do that many names though, you know. And so
it probably hurts you because you've built this. You spent years getting to this point.
Yeah,
and then you're like, you know, I feel like God does this sometimes where like you have these like moments where you get some just true clarity in the most unique way.
That was for me.
Right? Yeah. Like you were just like, hold up. Why did I start this? Like you have to almost go back boom to that one moment you realize that's why I started this.
So yeah. So exactly. That happened to me. And I had this moment right there at the store. And I was like, you know, I heard about this guy that doesn't do insurance. He doesn't, you know, and he takes great care of patients and people just like rave about him. His name is Doug Farrago, Dr. Farrago.
Okay.
And so he is, turns out, one of the pioneers of direct primary care, and he lives here in Lynchburg. What? Go figure. And so I call this guy like outside of the store. I'm still standing in the parking lot and I'm like, hey, I know you don't know me, but this is what's going on. And he says, it was his wife that was on the phone, and she was like, yeah, I'll have him call you when he's done with patients. Like 2 minutes later, Dr. Frager was on the phone. He's like, yeah, come on over. I don't have anybody going on right now.
Yeah.
And I sat down and I didn't stand up for 2.5 hours, and he just chatted with me about his story and how things changed for him. And,
come on.
And it was great. It spoke to me. And that's when I came up with my list of seven things. Well, I reviewed my list of seven things and I was like, this fits all of them. And so it was done after that. We made our decision, and within, I think it was like 94 days of me hearing of direct primary care, I opened the doors of my office. So like,
that's awesome.
It was busy.
That's awesome.
It was busy.
So let's break it down for people like looking at direct primary care, okay? So direct primary care is not like health, it's not health insurance. So that's the first thing.
Yeah.
And then second thing, so how do I get direct primary care? Do I just say, sign me up, doctor? Like, how does this, like,
yeah.
What makes it direct? So that means it's you to me.
Yeah. And that's pretty much it. And so
it's like a subscription.
It is. It's kind of like Netflix does medicine.
There we go.
But yeah, so if you use it, I mean, you pay for it, and we're there. The reason direct primary care didn't start earlier is because there was a gentleman doing it up in, I think it was Connecticut several years ago, and there was a large insurance company that came down and said, hey, we're going to take you to court because you are claiming to do what we do, that is pay a certain amount every month whether or not you need it for healthcare. And I don't know what happened all with the lawsuit and everything, but ultimately part of the Affordable Care Act was the fact that they recognized that direct primary care was not insurance. And so after that, it took off and it's grown by over 800% in the last 4 years. So it's coming all over the country. It's actually a little slower to get here in Lynchburg.
Well, trust me, there will be people signing up after listening to this podcast. There will be people that will share this. I know that there will be sojourners around the country and around the world that will be like, I need to talk to my primary care doctor, or at least look up and learn more about this.
Yeah.
We'll make sure to plug what's going on at Boonesboro DBC, just so people can start to learn about it.
Yeah, it's good. And it's all over the country. It's in big towns, it's in small towns. I'm in Lynchburg, case in point.
Okay.
And it's good. So what we do generally, direct primary care, is we take a smaller amount of patients so we can spend more time with our patients.
Yeah.
Me, one of the things that my patients complained about is waiting the hour or whatever. I don't know how long you waited for me in my old practice, but I don't want to know.
Hey, I was paid. You were worth it. You were worth the wait. Don't worry.
Oh, my goodness. But I didn't even build a waiting room. And so in my new office. And so we schedule
That's
patients.
Very true.
So it's every half hour or hour. So like my patients think I'm just sitting there all day by myself. But we design it that way. So patient leaves, patient comes, they don't see each other. And so that is on purpose. Like everything has been designed. And so we charge a monthly fee. For us, we do it. So it's like $80 for an individual, $135 for a couple, $165 for a family of five.
Now, what about if a Duggar family comes through?
Like, yeah.
19 kids. Like, where do you start charging?
You just charge 10 extra bucks per kid. And so
that's it? 10 extra bucks?
Yeah. So if you have a very large family, it's a great deal.
Are you kidding me?
So we have quite a few large families that have recognized this and signed up, and it's great for them. And so what they do, and a lot of people do, not just large families, a whole lot of people in our practice, they sign up for like a catastrophic insurance plan or one of these cost-sharing ministry type things that don't cover primary care. But 80% of all insurance claims are primary care. So the majority of what a person needs statistically is a family doc.
Got you.
And so we cover all that. So it's a really good match. So I tell people, you should have insurance in case you get hit by a train or have cancer or something terrible.
Right.
Heaven forbid. But for everything in between, and for even when that stuff happens and you get off of, seeing a jillion specialists and stuff like that, we're there to play quarterback and take care of everything because you need somebody with boots on the ground who knows you, who can say, yeah, I know this is going on. That's normal for some people. That's really abnormal for her.
Gotcha.
My patient. And so because of that, I mean, it has been wonderful.
Right.
It's been everything that I was missing before.
Come on.
And being able to take good care of patients because I know my patients.
And you give out your cell phone number, so if they need you or want to call
you. Yeah, I was late to this because I was chatting on the phone with somebody outside your house.
Yeah, I was like, look, this guy does not see. He's like, listen, I got to handle my patients.
But it's great because if you want somebody to micromanage a certain part of your life, you want it to be your doctor.
That's right.
And in my case, my mechanic too. That's what you want to have happen. And I have the bandwidth to do that now.
That's so good.
It's liberating. It's great. My malpractice even proves it. I mean, my malpractice dropped by over 90% when I switched to this model because insurance recognizes that doctors are less likely to get sued when patients have access to him or her and they actually know the patient. I mean, I know my patients. Like, we had a baby, like I said, 4 weeks ago, and people, like, I've sent pictures to people and because they ask about it, and it's just like super cool. And when you know somebody that well, like, it's more than me just taking care of somebody just because they're a patient. Like, they have become much more than that, and it's just really neat. It's really neat.
Man, it's cool. You are the man.
It's fun.
This is exactly, listen, for people listening to this right now, this is what medicine should feel like. Like, you should want to get to know your doctor, your primary care physician is so important to your life. I believe that you should want this relationship with him. This is my primary care doctor that I'm sitting at my studio that I built having a conversation about the healthcare industry. I mean, this man has walked me off the ledge of not eating meat no more. Yeah. He's helped I'm down to a healthy weight. And what I love about it is me and Dr. James outside of this podcast actually know each other. So like, I know that, and as our relationship builds, I can trust him that if I have a chest congestion and I feel like I'm dying, I can just call him and he'll be like, "Obey, calm down. I'm going to order you an inhaler. You're going to be fine. Here's probably what's going on. You need to get some Claritin D and you need to take this inhaler." And I'm just like, that's beautiful. You can have that relationship with your patients. And I want to ask, when people are looking for, like, you know, Boonsboro DPC and want to sign up and be a part of this, like, can, if this floods and then, you know, people just start coming out, we're like, are you going to take 2,500 patients? Or?
Heck no.
Okay.
Yeah. So like, so we, the magic number is 600. And Dr. Farrago, because he's kind of a pioneer in this, he came up with that number. And that's where he's been at for a few years now. And he can manage it. He sees enough patients and he doesn't see too many patients.
Right.
And he can still give them the attention they need.
Right.
But I mean, that's at worst a quarter of what we were seeing before. Wow. And as docs, in many cases, a lot less than that. And so, so yeah, 600's our max. And that's what I'll tap out at, because at that point, I stop being happy again. And so...
That's good.
You know?
That's good. You need to be happy. You need to be healthy yourself.
Well, yeah.
It's important, because that helps the relationship. It's symbiotic. Yeah.
And,
you know?
I mean, when you have people talking about their doc and stuff, if they don't trust their doctor, I mean, they just get these... willies, you know, they just don't feel good about it. And, you know, if you don't feel good about your doc, then you're like, can I trust what he or she is saying and all this? But if they have a vested interest in you as a person, your family and all that, then, I mean, that's just stuff goes out the window. And that's the number one concern of a lot of people. Can they trust what the doctor says?
Okay. I want to ask you, moving to the other section, I want to ask you a series of questions.
Yeah.
And some topics I want to touch on before we finish out.
Yeah.
One, Obamacare.
Oh boy,
I know this is a hot button one. There's people will be listening. This is where we're going there. I think it's important to, at least if we're going to talk about healthcare, talk about Obamacare, because I think that, you know, the Medicare for all. We're not going to talk about the politics side of the healthcare, but I just want you to A, explain to people what is Obamacare of right now from a doctor's point of view.
Yeah,
what it has done to you and your industry from your point of view.
Yeah,
and then I have one more question after that, but I just want you to explain those.
Okay, so this is a bill that was almost 2,000 pages long. And so there's a lot to cover in it. But in general, is what it is a systematic way to decrease the cost of healthcare.
Okay.
That's what it is. And so they started incentivizing docs, like we talked about before, and doing quality measures. And then another part of their quality measures is determining...
The quality measures was Obamacare?
Well, yeah, that's part of it. Yeah.
That was like invented by Obamacare, the quality measures aspect that we talked about earlier?
Yes. Back to the healthcare being really complicated, short answer is yes.
Okay.
And then one of the things that they look at is how much a doctor treats a patient for. So the average for pneumonia is X amount. And if you are coming under that amount, then you're winning in that quality measure. And so they've done a lot of different things for that. And so it has affected healthcare in good ways and in bad ways. And so they gave a lot of power to big health systems like hospitals.
Okay.
And so wherever these people are listening, just look at the healthcare system around you and how many primary care docs are by themselves, like very few. Because in the last several years, they've probably been purchased, and the same thing with specialists, by the healthcare system in the area, the big hospital, the biggest hospital in the area. And so they have these big health systems and people become numbers. And so I think that has been one of the problems that has come up with the Affordable Care Act. Is that there's really big groups that are responsible for the healthcare now, and they're incentivized by money, and then all of a sudden you have this huge increase in administrators, the 3,200% increase that we talked about.
Right.
And so people that aren't as invested in the actual health of a patient, that just clouds things. And so, in short, Obamacare is a systematic way to make things more affordable and better quality. How it has all panned out, not as we had expected. So that's 2,000 pages and many years boiled down into 2 minutes.
You did a great job. You did a great job. So now that we understand Obamacare, how has it affected you as a doctor? Do you, in your opinion, like, do you feel like it has aided you? Do you feel like it has hindered you? Do you feel like what's stopping the politicians from doing, like, what would you say? Like, if you could speak before Congress, would you tell them, hey, this is not the way to go? Would you say that Obamacare has just been maybe not the best exercise of their political wisdom?
Well, you know, and all of that's a good question. Everybody's opinion is tainted by their personal experience.
Of course.
And mine. I'll tell you mine.
And you're just speaking subjectively. We're not...
And so, so for me, I'm a med student. I graduated in May of 2012. And then shortly thereafter, we're talking a matter of weeks, the portion of Obamacare rolled out that made it so during residency, you couldn't defer your loans. So that is, student loans are insanity. Mine were huge, just over $250,000. And so,
wow.
I mean, just insane money. And so during your training, because you're getting paid by the government, you are allowed to defer your loans, meaning it wouldn't accrue interest. And so, and that's what it's been since the inception of this stuff. And so that changed with the Affordable Care Act. And so all of a sudden we were required to pay interest to the government, because that's where the majority of our loans come from, while we're getting paid by the government. And so, and they know how much we're getting paid. And so it's, I mean,
that's
when you do an hourly wage. I did surgery with the doc, and the people that cleaned up afterwards were getting paid more hourly than I was. And so there is no way that I could pay that bill. And so meanwhile, what? I'm accruing an insane amount of interest. So the 3 years that I was in residency, I accrued over $60,000 of interest. I mean,
dude, you're making me sweat.
You could do the math. That's a conservative estimate. I mean, I know it's more. I very clearly know that it's more than that. And
right.
But like huge numbers. And so that's something that affected me. And that's something I don't think a lot of people know about. And so it made people that, you know, back to the stereotype, that could pay it off later, it just runs the meter in a time that they couldn't pay it.
Right.
And so I didn't like that. And so I'm in more debt because of that.
Right.
So that's one of my experiences. The other ones, fast forward a couple years in residency, I was chief resident, and I had this very bright intern that came. Intern is like a freshman. It's like your first year of residency.
Right.
And she said, well, I didn't know DVTs, blood clots, were so common. And I was like, why are you saying this? And so what it is she said, oh, we put everybody on preventative medication for blood clots that comes in the hospital. And so I was like, yeah, you're right. You know, that's changed since I started a little bit. Why? And so I started looking into it more. And there's something called never events in the Affordable Care Act. And so this is interesting.
Yes.
And so there's a handful of things that they say this should never happen in a hospital admission. Some of them are a hospital-acquired pneumonia. And there's a whole slew of them. One of them is blood clots in the legs. Because blood clots in the legs can go to other parts of the body and cause big problems.
Right, right, right.
And so they're like, this should be preventable. Let's prevent it. And so what they said is, if any of these never events happen while you're in the hospital, then if you're getting paid by the government through whatever, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever, then we don't have to pay for it. And we won't pay for it. So if you're there for a huge thing, you know, $100,000 bill, and you get a blood clot on your last was going to be your last day, bam, the hospital has to foot that bill. And so you can imagine what that did to medicine. I shouldn't say medicine. I should say like protocol, like hospital protocol. They shifted. They're like, if we have a few of these happen, then we're like really hurting financially. And so everybody needs to do something to keep these people from getting blood clots or pneumonia or whatever.
Right.
And so that's what this doc was talking about, this brand new doc, because we were given shots in people's stomachs every day to give them medication that would thin their blood just so that they wouldn't get a blood clot, so that the hospital would get paid. Not because statistically their risks show that they need to be on that medication, but because it is technically a risk because they're in the hospital and they're not mobile and there's stuff going on, sometimes surgery and things like that. So they're in, their risk is a little bit higher. But I mean, the uptick of all these medications and all these things was enormous, and it happened right because of those never events. And so it shifted how medicine was being practiced. And I recognized that when this doctor pointed out, like, hey, I didn't know they were so common. They're not. It's just that the hospital won't get paid if a never event happens while they're in their hospital.
Yo.
And so
this is good.
That's something that happened to me. So that's experience number two.
Okay.
And so then experience number three, and I've already talked about, where all of a sudden I had to start checking all these boxes that we didn't know if they were pertinent or not. And then it got to the point where I was asked to see more patients because insurance is paying less. We still have lots of patients. So how do you get paid more? You see more patients. And so I started off with an average time here for patients, and then it went here, and then it went here, and then it went here, and my like sanity went here, and
right.
The morale that I had was below the table, and so that just happened because I was spending more time with a computer and less time with my patients. And so that's how it affected me. Those are my experiences with how healthcare has changed in the few years that I've been a part of it.
Right.
Yeah.
So to end that, just to tie a little bow, I want to know then, we've seen the best political attempt.
Yeah.
We've seen your attempt with DPC.
Yeah.
What would you say is a great, like, end goal? Like, what would you want to see, like, healthcare 10, 20 years? Or your kids' kids, where would you want to see healthcare at? Like, what would be, like, man, if we could figure this out, or if we could get people to understand this,
from
your point of view, we could start to really see some healthy changes that could be radical for people.
So there have been a lot of really smart people trying to work on this.
Yes.
And nobody's been successful as a whole.
Right.
One of my favorite stories is, and I think it's a made-up story, but about a kid walking along the beach with all these starfish that have gotten washed up on the shore and they're dying in the sun, and he's just taking one at a time and chucking them back into the water and saving one at a time. And somebody asked this kid, you know, why are you doing this? You can't save them all. And he, in answer to it, picks up another starfish and said, well, it made a difference to that one. And so I'm only taking 600 patients, and that's what I can do, and that's what I can take. That's the number that I can take really good care of. And so it'll make a difference to those 600. I won't be able to cure the masses, but I will take really good care of those 600. And so what I would like to see in my future, or my children's future, or grandchildren, is, hopefully it's sooner than that, but is personal care. I grew up in a little town. There was a little hardware store, and I would ride my bike. I mean, this is very, like, picturesque. Ride my bike down there and get nails for my dad, and whatever else he needed that day, a doorknob or whatever, for our Saturday chores while my mom was yard sailing. And they'd say, hey, Andrew, and they'd walk me through everything, and I'd be gone, and it was great. And then I remember when Lowe's opened up in the next town over, we'd go to Lowe's, and we'd, like, look around for people with those little vests on, and things just changed. And so we spent way more time, and it was just this huge industrialized thing. And that offered things that the little hardware store didn't, but, and I think it has its place, but I miss things like that. And I think stuff like that is important for healthcare because it's not just a doorknob that we're buying. It's years that we're hopefully adding on to our life or saving. And I mean, just a lot of things that are way more important than hardware.
That's good. That's good. Okay. To wrap this podcast up, because I don't want to keep you too long.
Yeah.
And we can definitely, you know, do this again. You're definitely welcome back at any time. This has been so good. I want to ask you just a series of questions.
Yeah.
And then we'll be done. Okay? Ready?
Fire away.
So, first one. What is one thing your parents instilled in you that you still keep today?
I would say validation. My mom gave this little lesson one day about validation. She defined it and talked about what it was. And we would do little lessons like this every Monday night, and it was to validate what somebody is doing and why they're doing it. And you've been to my office. I like quotes, and so I have quotes all over, some from patients. I mean, they take these like famous quotes and they paint them on canvas and they stick them on the wall, and I've got them from patients and family and former nurses and everybody. And so one of my favorites is be kind. Everybody's fighting a hard battle. And so that's what my mom taught me, is validation, and that people do things for a certain reason, and we're all fighting to do our best. And, you know, we're all doing our version of our best given our situation, and we never know anybody's full situation.
That's good. That's real good. All right. When I say a word, I want you to tell me the first thing.
First thing. Okay.
Football.
Football. Hokies.
LeBron James.
Tall.
Drake.
Singer. I got nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, you're partly right. Partly right. Okay. Centra.
Ugh.
That was a bad one. Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. No, be honest. Whitewater rafting.
Love it. You need to go with me.
That's right. We will definitely, we got to go. Let's do two more. Avengers Endgame.
Ooh, my wife hasn't seen it, so I can't say anything.
Cannot say, no spoilers. Okay?
Loved it, though.
The Office.
Ooh, great show, and I love My Office.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been an amazing time on the Podyssey. I hope, Sojourners, that you have taken something from this. Someone help this man with his Drake quotes, though. We gotta help him out. But to all the Sojourners out there, I hope that you guys will take this conversation. And like we say here at the Podyssey, we're about building healthy, just healthy, honest conversations within community around the world. So we want you to take all the information you learned today. We will hopefully provide some show notes, some places to go, click. We'll get definitely plug. Dr. Jason, you want to tell them, you know, where to find you, like anything you want to plug?
Nothing too much. Boonesboro, directprimarycare.com. That's us. It. There's a lot to learn out there. And if you Google it, like if you're outside of the area, it's everywhere in the country.
That's right. That's right. Also, don't watch What the Health or that any documentaries. Dr. Anderson's one of his biggest pet peeves is people that don't do your research. You don't have to go vegan. I'm just playing with you. For all my vegan friends, you're totally fine. But yeah, just I hope you guys enjoy this podcast. I hope you guys have learned something. I hope you guys take these conversations out into your own communities. Sit down with your own primary care doctor. Ask him some of these questions. See, you know, if you can encourage, and I hope Dr. Anderson, you know, I can call you Dr. Andrew now. I think we're close.
Sure.
Dr. Andrew definitely has hopefully encouraged some other doctor that may be listening to this or that you know of to do a direct primary care or to figure out a way to buck the system, because we need to, as a community, come together and find the best way possible within our communities to help each other with this problem, which is healthcare, and to provide the best quality care and to have relationships like this, because I think it's important. So Sojourners, have those conversations, and I hope that you guys have been encouraged by this podcast. And like your mom said, what was that last quote you said with your mom that she always told you?
Validation.
Be kind
because everybody's fighting a hard battle.
That's right. Sojourners, be kind because everyone is fighting a hard battle. That's right. My name is Obey. I'm your host. Till next time. God bless you.